Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 4, 2018. The first Thursday of each month is an introduction to the Buddha's Dhamma, and my talk tonight is based loosely on the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. This is a sutta where the Buddha describes the process of his own awakening and recognizing that initially he was engaged in an ignoble search, meaning a search that could not produce the understanding that he was seeking, and how he developed the noble search and then taught that. In fact, you could say for the rest of the Buddha's teaching career, for the last 45 years of his life, he taught the noble search based on an eightfold path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's the first Thursday. It's an introduction to the Buddha's Dhamma. Typically, I'll give a talk that incorporates what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, and then his the very first sutta he ever taught, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, with the understanding that everything the Buddha taught during his entire teaching career was taught in the context of those first two suttas. But I thought I'd, and I might touch on that later, I thought I'd do something a little bit different tonight. I mentioned it to Kevin a little earlier. There's a sutta called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, subtitled the Noble Search, which implies there's such a thing as an ignoble search. And it's a recounting of the Buddha's actual search and how he came to an understanding that simply seeking the truth, that if it's not focused correctly and headed in the right direction, you're not going to get there. There's a shorter sutta, which is really an extract of this, called the Pariyasana Sutta, that doesn't really get into the history of the Buddha and his involvement in his search. It's just an explanation of a noble or an ignoble search. So the sutta, the story begins in the sutta with the Buddha just at the point where he's leaving his family behind and starting to wander around northern India. I should say at this point, there's some people that say what a selfish thing for the Buddha to do, to leave his family, his wife and his just born son, and go out and seek understanding. But that is a complete misunderstanding of what was motivating the Buddha, and also what was a common practice during the Buddha's time, and maybe should be more of a practice today. It was understood, in fact, it was well valued by society when young men would do this and take up the arduous task of trying to develop understanding, with the understanding that if they could achieve their goal, it would be a benefit to everyone, including their family. So it wasn't something that was seen as a selfish act. In fact, in this sutta, the Buddha describes how his parents were crying when they left, his wife was crying, and yet he still understood that he needed to do this. And so he left his family behind at the age of 26 and started wandering around northern India with the hope and the intention to find a solution to the common problem of human suffering. And so you've heard me talk about the Nagara Sutta, where the Buddha describes his awakening, and the Loka Sutta, where he looks out on the world from his now awakened point of view and declares that the world is aflame, people in the world are aflame. And the conditions of the world today are nearly exactly the same as they were 2,600 years ago. And the cause of the problems of the world today are the same. There's many people that even come to this class that say, well, the Four Noble Truths really aren't relevant because the world has changed so much in the 2,600 years. Well, technologically, it's changed, and even philosophically, it's changed. But the root cause of ignorance of Four Noble Truths, of the way things are in reality, hasn't changed at all. And so the Buddha set out to seek an understanding of the nature of suffering in the world. And was there a way to understand this at its most profound level and to bring the suffering in the world to cessation? And so he set out wandering around northern India, studying with some of the most acknowledged spiritual teachers of his time. Two of them that are mentioned in the sutta are Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta, who both taught variations on what was presented in the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism, and the Upanishads, also a precursor to modern Hinduism. And the Buddha studied and very quickly mastered these teachings. Alara Kalama taught this teaching where the ultimate culmination of the teaching was entering into this this plane of nothingness, and meaning establishing yourself in this plane, which the Buddha later acknowledges is really just another imaginary plane where we're clinging to self to establish an existence there. He mastered this teaching very quickly in Alara Kalama's meditation techniques. Alara Kalama said, "I want you to join our community. You can be my equal as a teacher." And the Buddha said, "I understand you're sincere and you've mastered your teachings and your doctrine very well, but it doesn't lead to the goal, of unbinding, meaning release from clinging to wrong views that are prone to confusion and ongoing deluded thinking." And then he met up with Udaka Ramaputta, who taught something very similar, but the establishment in this realm of neither perception nor non-perception, which is a little bit confusing. It sounds almost ridiculous, and actually I think it is kind of ridiculous to seek something like that. But it's simply creating this space for your mind to engage in that is free of any discernment. You neither perceive anything, but you're not trying to not perceive anything. And again, it sounds pretty silly, doesn't it? Why would you want to do that? But again, this is something that came out of the Vedas. It was a common practice during the Buddha's time, and it continues to today. The modern practices of establishing yourself in emptiness, or realizing that there's no such thing as a self, or even the realization that somehow there's a hidden Buddha nature within all of us. That's all part of that type of magical thinking that the Buddha recognized does not lead one to the goal. And so, excuse me. He continued his search and eventually came to the realization that if you searched for the solution to the problem in something that was prone to the problem, you were simply getting caught up in that feedback loop that he mentions in the Nagara Sutta. In other words, the Buddha described dukkha, or suffering, as birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, not getting what is desired is suffering, getting what is undesired is suffering, and then he would close that with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So if your search is towards acquiring something that is in itself prone to birth, aging, sickness, death, prone to material achievement, meaning getting what you want, or avoiding the loss of something that you've already acquired, another form of acquisition, isn't it? Or seeking understanding through the physical form, through self-identification with the physical form, which often characterizes itself as elevating yourself to some other plane of existence, like Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta taught, or the modern adaptation of that is finding this inner Buddha nature. So the Buddha teaches that it is a ignoble search, a fruitless search, to seek understanding in something that is prone to the three defilements of greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking. Something that is prone or characterized as the three marks of existence. It's impermanent, it's a misunderstanding of self, and so it's prone itself to dukkha. So I hope I'm explaining this correctly, but do you see the feedback loop that the Buddha recognized and taught in Nagara Sutta in seeking in something that is in itself prone to suffering? Is that clear? So that's the description of an ignoble search. Upon the Buddha's realization of that, he then put his focus on what could be understood. And what is it that can be understood? Frank knows the answer to that. What can be understood is suffering through an Eightfold Path. What can be understood is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. What can be understood is that our preoccupation with self-identification to all things, the Buddha would often characterize that as you establish yourself now here and now there and everywhere in between. Understanding that brings the cessation of our contributions to suffering. Let me just finish this, right? And then the profound understanding that it is an Eightfold Path that leads us to the cessation of suffering. Frank.
Well, I was just, you caught me daydreaming about the statement you made earlier about how some of the lineages or traditions discount the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path or the teaching of dependent origination.
Yep.
And I was just kind of like recollecting the confusion and delusion and stress and all the realities of the first task of the Four Noble Truths. None of it would make any sense without it.
Yeah.
All the teachings would make no sense without it. And I don't understand. So that's what I was caught up in. I was caught up in that feedback loop of just trying to, I guess, figure out the ignorance of that.
Yeah, well, it took me a long time to figure out why that occurred. And I spent many, I spent many years ardently practicing modern Buddhism, really Mahayana Buddhism and a touch of Theravada, blaming myself for not being able to make sense out of something that you just described very accurately as, excuse the harsh word, nonsense in relation to what the Buddha taught. Because it has no foundation in what the Buddha taught, even though it's characterized this way. There's a few primary suttas that modern Mahayana Buddhism and Theravadins don't really discount it, two suttas that rely, that have formed the foundation for Mahayana Buddhism, and that is the Lotus Sutra and the Heart Sutra, and there's other words that are applied to that, more lofty words. But in both of those suttas are taught as a teaching of the Buddha that he taught while he was in physical form, while he was alive, having a human life. But he left the human form and went to, it's usually called Tulsita heaven, which is a type of Buddhist non-physical heaven, went there and gave these more advanced teachings to be preserved by, and I'm not making fun, this is how it's taught, preserved by the Nagas, which are the snake people, preserved there in a non-physical form until human beings were ready to understand these advanced teachings. And in those advanced teachings, later known as the Heart Sutra and Lotus Sutra, there's in those suttas it says you should discount the Four Noble Truths, discount even, it makes a direct reference to five clinging aggregates, and it creates an entirely different presentation of dependent origination. So when you look at it that way, and I won't get into the whole history of how that developed, but it began very early after the Buddha's passing, a desire to have a different type of so-called Dharma, it makes sense that the modern teaching, while they, you know, they're certainly legitimate philosophies and legitimate religions, they're simply not what a Buddha taught in a practical way. And so it leads to all that confusion. and grasping after then what the Buddha says to avoid, including in this sutta, grasping after rituals and practices that are in self rooted in the problem. So to get to the point of what you brought up and where I'm going with this is these are all very powerful and subtle strategies that allow one to ignore its own ignorance. You feel like you're doing something, don't you? And again, I spent many years kind of spinning my wheels, wondering why I wasn't going anywhere or gaining any understanding when all that I was doing was engaging in practices that allowed me to think that I was doing something, but it really was just ignoring my own ignorance. Frank.
The last day that we were up at the One Center, One Dharma Center, there was a fellow that came up to me after breakfast, or lunch, I forget what it was, and he said, what lineage do you guys follow?
Yeah.
What tradition do you practice? And I was looking at him and I said, we don't follow any of that. He said, well, what does John teach you? I said, John teaches us just what the Buddha taught. He only teaches the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and Dependent Origination, so that we have insight into three marks of existence. And he was like, huh?
Was that, I don't want to use his name, was that one of the reverends?
No, this was a lay person who was a member of the church or the...
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
He follows the Theravada.
It's interesting because that comes up a lot. In fact, I've had people verbally attack me online saying, you don't have any authority to teach. Who gave you the authority to teach? Nobody. Nobody gave the Buddha an authority to teach either, did they? And then people want to know, what's your lineage? Well, modern lineages claim their lineage goes all the way back to the Buddha. But as I just explained, they don't. They go back, some of them only go back a couple hundred years to a modern charismatic teacher. A true lineage, you think about the word lineage, a true lineage is not established through a teacher, even this teacher. A lineage is based on what the Buddha taught and his Dhamma. That's a true lineage. And so the lineage that we are a part of is a direct lineage back to the Buddha, because the only thing I teach is from that lineage. Nothing else can claim a true lineage, can it? Unless you want to get into the imaginative practices that somehow, you know, that story I gave about the snake people. And again, I'm not. It sounds like I'm disparaging, and I'm not. But a good deal of the Buddha's teachings, including this sutta that I'm referencing, and I'll teach it more in depth in a couple of weeks. Learning the difference between Alarakalama and Udaka Ramaputta were the two most recognized, advanced, so-called spiritual teachers of his time. But the Buddha understood that it would be cruel to simply adapt them and take a position of power immediately. Now, just think about this. This is a young man, 26, 27 years old, maybe 28. It might have taken him a couple of years to get through this. What young person would not take the invitation to be held up? If the Pope came up to a 26-year-old man and said, you are wonderful, I want you to be the second Pope and come and sit with me in Rome, it'd be hard to resist that, wouldn't it? But that was the offer made to young Siddhartha. And he said, that's a cruel thing to do. It doesn't lead to the goal. I'm not going to do it. Kevin, you had it before I go further.
The sutras that you described, the Heart Sutra and the other one, they really were developed after the Buddha's death. They were based on his words. They were something that was...
Yeah, they're... They're really, to use the word, because it relates to dependent origination, from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications, they are complete fabrications. Again, it's kind of like saying, I remember when I was really trying to figure out what was going on with Catholicism and Christianity, and looking at the Bible, not that I'm a Bible scholar, but looking at the difference between the Old Testament and New Testament, and basically being told, well, the Old Testament is really a fable, but the New Testament isn't. Okay, again, a brief explanation or a quick explanation of that. The justification for the modern teaching, so-called, Heart Sutra, Lotus Sutra, there's a couple of the Platform Sutra and the Diamond Sutra, a few of the other ones. And it's interesting that four or five sutras form the foundation of Mahayana Buddhism when the Buddha gave thousands of sutras. I could spend a couple of lifetimes and I wouldn't teach them all. But it's often taught that the suttas, as are preserved in the Pali Canon, are archaic. And we can't really know what the Buddha actually taught. Well, we can when you actually read them. You understand and you can see clearly the consistency from one sutta to the next. And if you understand that they all relate to dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths, it becomes clear how to apply them. There's no ambiguity in there. They're very, and you all know that, they're very direct and actually simple to apply, but it's still difficult to pierce our own veil of ignorance until we get to that point. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, so they're like after the Mahanga
Sutta. Yeah, well, I might as well mention it. So about 100 years after the Buddha's passing, there was a second council, and the emergence of this sect called the Mahasanghikas, who wanted a much more visionary type of dharma, more related to what the Buddha rejected from the Vedas. And they wanted to establish the Buddha not as a human being teacher, but as a god and one of many Buddhas or gods, going extending back into the infinite past and forward into the infinite future. And so that was the beginning of the rift. They became stronger over time, and eventually that became the formation for modern Mahayana Buddhism. So even understanding historically, which if you're going to claim a lineage directly back to the Buddha, you have to ignore the preserved history. But there it is. They wanted something different. So the Heart Sutra and the Lotus Sutra, even scholars have a difficulty placing them. But the Heart Sutra likely wasn't even formalized. And nobody knows where it came from unless you believe that it was came from the Buddha. Nobody knows who wrote it, but it was likely at least 1,000 years after the Buddha's passing. And the Lotus Sutra is probably 2,000, in other words, 600 years ago, maybe going back 800 or 900 years. There is a famous teacher, I guess this is kind of an introduction to the Dhamma, isn't it? There is a famous teacher going back into Mahayana Buddhism called Nagarjuna, who takes his name from Naga, the Nagas, the snake people. And he's the one that started establishing a Dhamma that was incredibly similar to what Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta taught to the Buddha 2,600 years ago and rejected by the Buddha. And when you read Nagarjuna, I tried to make sense of his writings. In fact, I tried really hard. If you read anything by Nagarjuna, it'll twist you up pretty good. But his whole point is really that idea of nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception. And he tries to reconcile everything into that Vedic view. And that really formed the foundation for what would come later from some of the great Zen teachers such as Dogen or Hui Neng, who wrote the Platform Sutra, and leading to this annihilation of the self, and that there's no such thing as a self, and everything is one big empty void, but somehow we should establish ourselves in that void. And the idea, and so the reconciliation from that has to be that if everything is a void, yet we have a Buddha, then that somehow that Buddha nature must be inside us and inside this void of nothingness. It's hard to reconcile it, isn't it? It's hard to understand it. I don't understand it. But I understand where it came from, and it was a very convenient way to continue to ignore our own ignorance within a practice that was designed to recognize and abandon ignorance. So getting back to, to tonight's story. So the Buddha continued his search in integrating now what he knew was to be abandoned, an ignoble search, and what was to be emphasized as a noble search. Along the way, he had come across these five friends that he was now, and this, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta doesn't get into the severe ascetic practices, but it does make mention of it. And so he practiced with these folks, these very severe ascetic practices, and finally, out of his own frustration, left that behind. And you know, I've told this story a few times, and it's recounted slightly differently in the sutta, but he decided that he is going to meditate with the understanding that he now developed, that he can't be looking where there's no understanding to be found. And I won't get into the whole understanding that he developed in that meditation, but I will talk about it in a few weeks. During this meditation session, an extended session, he came to understand and gain great insight into the three marks of existence, that all things in the phenomenal world are impermanent, that the way that he was looking at himself, his view of himself, did not constitute a self. It was not a self. That word means anatta in the old Pali, another misunderstood word. And because of his misunderstanding and attaching himself to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, rooted in ignorance of what truly constituted a self, a human being, something the Buddha never discounted, that resulted in all manner of suffering. And it was upon his gaining that understanding that it is said that he awakened. What did he awaken to? He awakened to those three marks of existence, that all things are impermanent, that up until that point, I had a misunderstanding of who I was in relation to the world, and because of that, I created suffering for myself. And then extrapolating that onto the world, and now he understood the cause of all the world's ills because of that lack of understanding. And so because of that lack of understanding, we crave for and we cling to things that are self-identifying. And once we do that, once we create that clinging, then we're bound to defend that. And so that occurs in very practical ways through competitiveness and aggressiveness. The Buddha noticed that in the marketplace when he first left his father's palace, his father's kingdom, and went out into the world. And he couldn't understand that. And that related to his search, the noble search. You can't be looking for understanding in that which is prone to that type of thinking. And so even from the individual competitiveness and aggressiveness that he saw, he also understood that that was taken to the level of kingdoms fighting amongst themselves, to wars, and all of the ills of society. So now he understood this. He had this great understanding. He's now awakened. He's known as the Buddha. He never referred to himself that way. He referred to himself as the Tathagata, which means the one who has left the world behind, meaning he has disentangled himself from the world and gone forth towards awakening. Of course, we all know the Buddha didn't become a hermit or a recluse. He was deeply involved in the world, more so than he ever was post his awakening than he was before. And he spent the last 45 years of his life teaching anyone and everyone who was interested. So the Buddha's now awakened, and he considers, how can I teach what I know? But also understanding that it's the common problem of human ignorance and how people will ignore, create these very powerful strategies to ignore their own ignorance. How can I teach it? And he decided that there must be a way to frame our thinking so that we can recognize and abandon, ultimately, ignorance. And that's where he developed the Eightfold Path. And so in this recounting in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, it uses metaphor again, which is used throughout the Pali Canon. Metaphor is used in this way either to describe a troubled mind state rooted in ignorance, such as the use of Mara, that malevolent god that comes in and out of the Pali Sutta, the Sutta Pitaka, or to describe a heightened quality of mind that we're referencing. So in the Aryaparyasana Sutta, the Buddha engages with a Brahmin, I can't think of his name right now. And the Buddha had decided that it was so difficult to teach the Dhamma that he, and these are the words that are recounted in the Parisana Sutta, that it would be too tiresome and troublesome for him. And he kind of decided, well, I'm just not going to do it. I don't think it's going to work anyway. And so this Brahmin came to, the legend is that the Brahmin left his non-physical abode and came and joined the Buddha in the physical plane of earth. Of course, that's just the Buddha's higher reasoning that he's referring to. But it's a useful teaching tool during the Buddha's time recounting this way, because that's simply the way they're related. They use metaphor in that way as teaching tools. So the Brahmin begs the Buddha, he says to the Buddha, there are some people with just a little dust in their eyes. Please, for their welfare, they're ready to hear this, they can learn it. Please go out and teach what you know. And three times the Brahmin made this plea to the Buddha. Finally, the Buddha relented and said, okay, I'll go out and teach. And so he got up off his cushion and started walking around northern India. And he headed towards a region where he knew he might find his five friends, thinking that they should be the people that I teach first. But actually, he came across a fellow who noticed the Buddha's countenance. In the sutta, it says he noticed his clear complexion, meaning he was bright and vibrant. And he asked Siddhartha, now the Buddha, he says, who's your teacher and who do you follow? Where did you learn from? And he says, I won't get into that whole teaching either. He says, I didn't learn from any teacher. There is no one who surpasses my understanding. I taught myself. And then he goes into a little bit of an explanation of what he knows and the ignoble search and the noble search. And this gentleman said, nah, I don't think so. And he walked away. The Buddha he wasn't dissuaded. And he continued walking towards Uruvela. And there the five friends that he had been wandering around northern India with, practicing these ascetic practices, saw the Buddha coming. And they had decided that the Buddha was now living, and they noticed he would look healthier, and he put on some weight. And they said, our buddy Siddhartha, he's living this luxurious life. He's engaged in all this abundance of the world. We don't want anything to do with him. When he gets here, we're just going to shun him. But as he got closer, they realized that he had achieved what they were looking for. And so they decided to listen to him. And actually, there was a discussion where the Buddha said, I found what we're all looking for. And he says, no, we don't think so. And he says, yes, listen to me. I know what I'm talking about. And they finally relented. They made a seat for him, and he gave them his teachings, taught them how to engage in a noble search and how to avoid an ignoble search. In this particular sutta, it doesn't recount the entire Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, because the sutta itself is on what is a noble search and what is an ignoble search. But they listened to him. We know the story that they understood what he was teaching. And so now the Buddha was established in the world with an original Sangha, and having understood the difference between what is a noble search and what is an ignoble search. And the great questions that you had and a little bit of discussion we've had so far pointed to that, isn't it? You know, the ignoble search has led to modern dharmas that cannot lead to the same understanding that an awakened human being taught. So I think that's enough of an introduction to the Dhamma tonight. So thank you for listening. Any other questions about this particular sutta? We'll go around the room. Again, in this sutta also, I failed to mention that he teaches the five friends the importance of using meditation in the proper way as part of a noble search. And in that, in the sutta, he describes that we use meditation to deepen jhana, to deepen concentration, and nothing else. And that's, again, that's the series of talks we're going through right now here, here in our center, are all on that, on jhana, and understanding what that means. And nothing magical or mystical about the different levels of meditative absorption either. So, Mike, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too. Good to be here. Enjoyed your talk very much, and I don't really have anything to add.
I'm glad
still
you
trying with my practice.
Good. Yeah, I'm glad you came tonight. Kevin, how are you?
Very well. It's an interesting talk, and puts things in perspective. So, you know, just continue to meditate and continue to follow the Dhamma.
Yeah, that's what we do, isn't it? Thank you. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. Good to see Mike and Kevin and yourself, John. I kind of like directed suttas, and I get the introduction to the Dhamma. But for me, it's like I get swept away with all that information. And I always come back to thinking about the Four Noble Truths, and really the first one, because I spend a lot, because the first one is reality for me all day long. That's my reality. Disappointment, stress, and I'm always feeling like I'm on the cutting edge of that with my understanding now. I do feel the relief from that I get through right view. And in my own practice, I can see how important meditation is.
Yeah.
I devote an hour and 15 minutes a day on a minimum to my meditation practice. And sometimes I feel like it's not enough. And the more time that I commit to it, it seems like the more time I have during the day. It's kind of weird. And then the mindfulness practice, I can see now the mindfulness that I use in meditation and the refined mindfulness that was always so confusing to me when you were first introducing it to the class. I'm like, what does that mean, refined mindfulness? But now I can see when I'm in impermanence and when I can when I can feel the five clinging aggregates going on, I'm an observer of it. And like I said, it keeps me right outside of that entanglement. I'm on that edge, you know. It's like if I'm skiing down a slope and I'm carving on an edge, you know, it's like that's kind of like steering me through my day.
Yeah.
The understanding, the right view. So I would have to say that I'm guided all day by right view. And that's what it feels. Even when you were talking, my mind was like distracted and I was going off and all kinds of things. I kept coming back to my breath and right view. So anyway, I appreciate it, John.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. That's the culmination, isn't it? Right view. That's how the Buddha describes. And right view from an awakened point of view is a profound understanding of the nature of suffering. That's what we hold in mind. The sutta that I'm referencing is useful because it provides ongoing direction about where we should be focused on. What a true noble search is. Ending in an understanding of four noble truths. So, it's remarkable in that way. I will teach this sutta probably in a couple of weeks, and it fits nicely into this series on jhana.
What was the name of the sutta again?
The Arya Pariyasana Sutta. It's not even published on the website yet. I'll probably put it up in a couple of days.
Aryapana?
Arya Pariyasana Sutta. It'll be, you'll see it in the newsletter.
Translated to what?
Noble Searches.
Noble Search.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, the idea, the a good indication of the importance of meditation is when we find our minds troubled in any way or agitated in any way, because then we know that we need to deepen our concentration. It's not that we're doing something wrong or we're off the path or anything, or at least it shouldn't be looked at it that way. But the ultimate culmination of the jhana practice, you know, when the Buddha said, when he wanted people to go meditate, he said, go find a root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana, meaning do something, do this practice, shamatha vipassana meditation, to increase your concentration. And when you think about the culmination of a well-concentrated mind is a mind that is not prone to distraction. And any disturbance in the mind is a distraction, isn't it? So when we find ourselves in any troubled mind state, we know the solution. Take to our cushion.
Well, that's why I'm referring to all day, I'm dealing with people who are from no reason, I mean, they just don't understand. They're taking everything personal all day long.
Yeah.
They're excitable, they're anxious, they're depressed, they're overzealous, they're like whatever, they're over something all day long. And I'm just like, how do you teach that to somebody, right? How do you teach what I know, what I've learned to somebody who desperately needs it? You can't really do it through right speech. It has to be shown. Like I had somebody say to me today, why are you always so calm? They said, really, like what are you doing that you're always so calm? And that was a really good compliment because it never used to be that way. I'm like, you can't really do anything about the things that you can't change. You know, and you really shouldn't be taking it personal because there's nothing in life that's personal.
Yeah.
You know, how can you say that nothing's personal? You know, so it's very difficult for me to try to tell somebody or explain to somebody what they should be thinking. They have to go through the experience. And all I can suggest to them is start meditating, and I point them to the webpage for guided instruction, and hopefully something would happen for them.
And that is all you can do. You know, I always say that the Buddha's first teaching was to those five friends, but it really was to that first gentleman that he met on the road. And he failed, didn't he? He didn't take it personally, though. He just kept going. So all that we can do, and again, this is what the Buddha did, is be an example by having a calm presence. It's the most powerful thing we can do. You know, you hear me say this often. The most loving thing I can do for myself and all other human beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because then I can be a true example of this. It's the only thing that is going to get people interested, and even that's not always enough, is it? What else can we do? Mm-hmm. Insisting that the world be different is rooted in ignorance, isn't it? The world is the way it is. Because the world is rooted in ignorance. But because the world is rooted in ignorance doesn't mean I have to stay that way. In fact, that's one of the great realizations of the Buddha. He, before he could teach a Dhamma, in this sutta, you know, I mentioned tonight, he early in the sutta, he says, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, or bodhisattva, which is something that he referred to himself over and over again, meaning he was a human being with great compassion, but lacking the understanding of how to do anything about it. And it's interesting that the main path in Mahayana Buddhism is called the Bodhisattva path, something that the Buddha said is that's preliminary to awakening. So all that we can do is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. And then if other people are interested, we can do it, Frank. You know what you do is, it, you know, here's, you know, look here, you can do this. I did it, and maybe you'll develop awakening. But again, the Buddha never saw himself as savior. He didn't hope to teach a salvific religion. He just wanted to reach the people that he could reach. But And think about the profound effect he's had over 2,600 years ago. The teachings are still here. I think that's one of the most remarkable things about my life, is that I found these teachings, that I have a mind that can use. Not that I have anything special. You know, the Buddha taught a Dhamma for any human being to understand, but that I can actually utilize these teachings and feel the effects. You know, know the effects too. It's important. Ah, that was a good introductory class, I think, wasn't it? Again, there's a series of anjanas that I'm going through. All the recordings are on the website. Saturday Sutta is going to be on something called the Samadanga Sutta, Samasamdanga Sutta, which is really an analysis, an in-depth analysis of jhana. And I'm going to repeat that class on Tuesday because there's a lot in there. Let's finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you. Glad you made it. Glad you all made it.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.